Are you ready for new dimensions and countless possibilities today and for the future? It's an exciting new time, and the answers are out there. So join Mary Jane Popp as she explores the unique and unusual for a better life on Pop Talk in search of the truth. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
And welcome to Pop Talk. Hey, got some good ones for you. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking about the angel and the avatar. And you're going to go, what? What the heck is that all about? Well, we're going to be talking about the mental crisis that Doreen Mary Bray says, no, it's not a mental crisis. It's a soul crisis. We'll find out what that means. But before we do that, how can we get back on track? It seems like the whole world is upside down, inside out. We've got wars all over the place, and others may be popping up any times. So how do we get from healing of war to peace? Well, maybe, just maybe, we have some suggestions from someone who has really been studying this for quite some time, and maybe he has some suggestions for us.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door.
Well, the word peace seems to be battered these days. So how can we get back on track? Well, P.K. Edgewater offers a timely and deeply human perspective on how to recover after conflict. And that is kind of war, isn't it? But going deeply into the mental health challenges that follow trauma, grief, moral injury, and healing from the word war. Now, his work, Passages, it's a voyage from war to peace, and it delves into emotional resilience and what it takes to truly move toward peace. Now, PK is a Vietnam veteran and doctor of 40 years, and he really penned a novel that explores all these challenges and a whole lot more. Nice to have you with us, PK.
Thanks, Mary Jane. Thanks for that introduction.
You bet. Hey, well, it's true. I always tell it like it is. Everybody goes, was that true? No, I lie to you all the time. No, of course it is true. All right. But there's always been war, PK. We seem to have survived through it. But I don't know if we'll ever reach, you know, I always think of like Star Trek, and they're always looking for peace and, you know, other species and all that kind of thing, other planets. And it seems that there's always some kind of war that pops up. As long as there is human, in this case, there's going to be war. There's always going to be some kind of conflict. So how do we deal with that? Just accept it?
You're asking me?
Yeah. You're the expert, not me.
Let me clarify. I am not an expert on war. I am an expert on you know, watching people go through hard things, frankly. So the novel that I wrote, this is a literary fiction novel,
mm-hmm.
Passages, A Voyage from War to Peace, and it's for readers who like multi-layered tales of transitions, relationships, moral injury, and healing. You might compare it to Richard Rousseau's Nobody's Fool or Claire Keegan's Small Things Like This. In the story, picture the police dragging an aging, drunk Vietnam Navy combat veteran into a public hospital to get a psychiatric evaluation. And therein, he gets matched up with a young psychiatrist in training from another country. Now, through their encounters, their therapeutic encounters, the reader will learn of the rites of passage for each of these interlocutors to get to this point in their lives, and why the vet had a single round in the chamber of his weapon when he was arrested. So yes, I've had a long career in medicine, and along with my five siblings, my military service was during the Vietnam conflict.
Got it.
But with passages, a voice from war to peace, I sort of drag the reader backwards through the hedge, so to speak, to think about trauma, healing, relationships, and maybe reflect on their own transition. And some readers will thank me for that.
Oh, absolutely. And I understand what you're saying. Now, you're a Vietnam vet. My husband was a Vietnam vet. He's passed away now, but
yes.
He was a Vietnam vet. And isn't it just a matter of survival? I'll be honest with you. Now, maybe you had the same experience. Most Vietnam vets did not talk about Vietnam when they came back. Right? Am I right or what?
You are right. So let me just give you a little background. You know, our family experience with my siblings sort of was during the full arc of the Vietnam conflict. My sister, the oldest, joined the Marine Corps along with a girlfriend. They just wanted to have an adventure and get out of working in a cafeteria after high school. But that was, you know, the U.S. was involved in Vietnam then, but not in a hot conflict yet. And then at 17, my eldest brother was getting into trouble in school and home and eventually dropped out of high school and joined the Navy. And then the next three brothers, when they graduated high school, followed him into the Navy. And it was during those years, as you'll remember, from the mid-60s to early 70s, that the war ramped up and became increasingly controversial as the casualties mounted.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you remember those times.
Yes.
For my part, when I graduated from high school, I was recruited to the Air Force Academy by the wrestling coach. And I couldn't turn that down. That was an opportunity. But this was at the time when the U.S. was beginning to wind down, and then we had this very messy withdrawal from Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
But the combined experiences of my siblings and I, through the arc of the war, were brought home to our family house where we had a rich mix of experience for thought and discussion. And it revealed some aspects, and is a key aspect of the psycho-emotional impact of war on young people that most readers may not be aware of. And I think that's one of the secrets of the book that readers will enjoy.
Well, you know, it's amazing because, of course, I can say that I had the experience with the Vietnam War because of my husband. We were married only three. Well, he went through OCS. He was at Indiana University. He became a second lieutenant. We married, and I didn't know but he was going to go to Vietnam because he wouldn't have told me. He didn't want to tell me.
Tell me about that experience.
Well, the experience was, if he would have told me he was going to Vietnam, I would not have married him, bottom line. And he knew that. So he didn't tell anyone, not even his parents, that he was going to Vietnam. We married in January, and we were about a month into our marriage before he finally told me that he's going to have to go to Vietnam in about 2 months. And I'm going, what?
Wow.
You know, but, you know, it's just amazing how survival kicks in. Survival kicks in. You accept what's happening and then figure out how to deal with it. Instead of if you go wacky-doo, you know, and just go every which way but logical, it ain't going to work. It's not going to work. I was very fortunate. He came back pretty normal, believe it or not. And he was a little older, too, and I think that made a difference.
He was older and he was an officer, right?
Yes, yes. And he was looking after the youngsters. He took them under his wing because at that time there was a lot of drug use. There was a lot of, you know, they'd come back to the base and then go out and fight during the day, then come back. It was a crazy time. They were told to actually fight a war with their one hand behind their back. They didn't call it a war, but it was a war, you know, whether you like it or not. But it was because he was a little older and he was looking after the other ones that were younger. I think that really gave him the responsibility, the discipline to do the best he possibly could, because he was a good officer, very good. And matter of fact, he stayed.
I'm grateful for your husband's leadership as an officer and for his service. That it was probably what kept him grounded.
It was.
And that can be said about much of the officer corps.
Yeah, and he also stayed in the reserves until he retired, and he retired as a lieutenant colonel. So
he was a
good man, but he worked hard, and he felt very close to these young people because he knew they couldn't come back and you know, be able to keep up the drug use and everything here, and it would ruin their lives, et cetera. So he'd keep them busy. They weren't real fond of him in some ways because if he, you know, figured that they were not going to listen to what he was saying and get off or don't get on the drugs, he made sure that they did, one way or the other. And I'm sure eventually...
I'll bet they heard more than he thought they did.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway,
how did the experience affect you? And tell me about your feelings when he came home.
Well, let me tell you, before he came home, his parents, as he was getting on the plane to leave, gave us each a tape recorder, old-fashioned tape recorder.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we wrote letters to each other, but we also sent tapes to each other, cassettes.
Oh, that's magic. That's so valuable.
Absolutely, because, I mean, I would listen to him telling me about it, what he did that day or what he was into or what experiences he had, and I could hear the monsoon rains in the back, you know.
Oh my gosh.
He would ask me what I was doing at Indiana University because I was working on my PhD and I was performing and all this. And it felt like, we were separated, but we weren't. Is that a funny way to say it?
Yes, it's perfectly reasonable. You know, you think about nowadays when our soldiers go abroad, they take their cell phones and they can be in direct contact.
Yes.
Often. Back then, it was letters and it was tapes, and that's what we got by with.
It's all we had.
Wherever you were.
Yeah.
And it was very valuable to hear the spoken word of someone you love.
Yes.
It's very calming.
When I saw him during R&R, which was about 7 months into it, in Hawaii, I know this may sound strange, but it was as we had never been separated. It was just, just like maybe a weekend.
Not even a warm-up 5 minutes?
No, hey, you know. And then he came back during that crazy stuff that you're talking about in 1972.
Yeah.
And for almost a week, I didn't know if he was alive or dead or where he was.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And then finally found out that he called me when he got to Seattle. He was in Seattle. I said, where have you been? You know?
Hallelujah.
He made it. He made it. But it was so strange because when we got back together, it was the most amazing thing. We were married when he passed away, just shy of 53 years.
Oh, my God. Well, congratulations. Yeah. Gee, I was going to ask you, do you think it will last?
Yeah. We always used to tease.
53 years.
Before he passed, we would tease, and we'd say, married 53 years, messing around for 57. and people would laugh, and I'd say, laugh all you want, but, you know, we're telling you like it is.
That is so valuable.
Yeah, and laughter had a lot to do with it, too. He would tell me about he had a pet, was it like a lizard, little lizard that would crawl on the window outside, and he'd tell me about his pets, you know. But that's what it makes, to take it and be from the heart. If you put your heart and soul into anything, whether it's a relationship or a career or love, it carries. It does. I mean, I've been doing radio and television for 51 years. You know, it's just, it's one of those.
You've done a marvelous job. I've looked into your background.
Oh, okay.
I know who you've been talking to.
Oh. I've learned to learn. When I've had wonderful people on the air, the things that they would share with with me and my listeners was it was invaluable because you could take that information and incorporate it into your life. And what better learning process is it than getting it from persons like you who experienced all this?
Well, you know as well as anyone on earth that a life of curiosity is what brings so many consequential discoveries from unlikely sources.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to learn, you have to discipline yourself to listen hard, to truly say, hear what the other person is saying. And most of us need to exercise turning off that little voice in our head that wants to supply the answer we think we already know.
Yeah.
And that's where the value comes from, not just the knowledge that can be gained from a person who's had other experiences than we've had, but really for connecting with them genuinely and honestly.
How do we...
So you know this.
But how do we turn people into not only... I always say, money and power, power and money dominates. It does dominate. It's just the way it is with the human equation.
It's inescapable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how do we get into the person's inner something? Psyche, call it intuition, call it love, call it hate. I don't care what you call it. But in to be able to share what is inside of you instead of only what's outside of us.
You know, I think, I know you know the answer to that question. You keep asking questions. Whatever information you get, you drill down a little deeper. And most of the time, if you take the time, that person will reveal their core. And then everything else makes sense after that.
Mm-hmm.
Just by what they've done and where they've been, drill down by probing, you'll get to those answers.
And it takes patience. See, that's the thing we don't have a whole lot of these days. We don't have patience.
Yeah.
Automatically, we just go to AI, you know, write a paper for me, get this information for me. When I went through Indiana University and I worked on my bachelor's and my master's, I was working on my PhD, we still had to go to the library, you know, and look up information. I didn't have AI to say, write my paper, you know, or, find this information for me, right?
I know what you're saying. You know, when I was in my medical training, there were no computers.
No.
There were no cell phones. You know, we ran around in training, you know, collecting knowledge and writing it down in this little pocket-sized book, which we called it our peripheral brain,
you know.
And, you know, nowadays, you know, students from the get-go, they've got a world encyclopedia right in their pocket, taking up less room than that little pocketbook. That we carry. But it's, you know, it's progress. I love to see progress. It's jarring sometimes. We get confused on how to use it best. It's interruptive, it's disruptive. But I have faith in the human race. We will rise above and we will tackle and benefit from all these innovations that humans can generate.
Will we ever learn that war does not solve it?
You know, it's I don't know. You know, back to the book passages. I mean, the trajectory of the novel is set in the looming context of military conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope that it would be useful for vets and their families, not just from Vietnam, but any generation, any country.
Absolutely, yeah.
Just so the vets know that they're not alone and that those invisible wounds are also real and that the moral injury that they've had to face can be named and reasonably managed. But the situations in the novel, the character portrayals and some of the therapeutic messages, I really intended to have a broader application or lives beyond military families.
Good.
People that are impacted by domestic or sexual violence, chronic diseases, disabilities, displacement, migration, experiencing homelessness, even experiencing a major automobile accident can set in motion the sequence of events that can break down someone's psyche and provoke, substance abuse disorder and even self-harm.
All the issues.
I hope those lessons come through in the novel.
All the issues that you just mentioned, that is, in a sense, a war. You're fighting a war to make it through, right?
That's the point, yes. Thank you.
Yeah. And it makes good sense. And everybody has their own. I mean, and you go through, it doesn't only have to be one thing. We have multiple issues that we go through life. If you live long enough, you're going to hit a lot of different bumps in the road. And you have to take it as it comes, figure out what to do about it, and work at it. And that's the whole thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, most of us have quite a deep well of resilience, but sometimes it takes help from other human beings, professionals, to help us access that resilience. I've been asked so often, why is military historical fiction so popular? Well, it's because war is real. It's not science fiction. There's no superheroes. And human history is just replete with bloody tribal and transnational conflict. So there's all this material to draw on, and it's difficult to imagine a more dramatic arena.
Yeah.
So that's why military war is emblematic of all these other forms of trauma that people contend with.
And you know what, PK, I got to be honest with you. I sometimes wonder about people. Don't we learn? Don't we learn from our mistakes? I can understand a person making mistakes. We all make mistakes. I don't know anybody that's, maybe one person that was, didn't make mistakes. Look what happened to him. He got crucified. History. People are trying to change history. You learn from history. Did we do everything perfect historically? No. But if you take the history, learn from the history, and make changes to make a better world, that's right there is something right in front of your face to use. And people kind of throw it away. We don't need to talk about the negative things. Of course we do. What do you mean?
Absolutely. You have to be genuine. You have to, talk about problems. You're taking us down a curious avenue for discussion. You talk about learning. Do we learn lessons?
Mm-hmm.
I think individually we do, and maybe in family groupings and small groupings we do, but nations and civilizations over the centuries seem to have to relearn all of this. We're struggling to get to a utopia that nobody seems to be able to get to because we normalize these types of conflicts. We normalize war. It's just one tool in a set of political instruments for to exert national power, and we just got to get by that. And, I think there's the biggest evil in the world, in my mind, is not necessarily money. It's power. It's the lust for power.
Yeah.
It's the egotistical lust for power that leads to most of these conflicts. Somebody wants to be the chief of a bigger and bigger and bigger tribe, and they could get to that, and they won't be happy then, and they won't learn. But we got to keep trying. We have no option not to keep trying because we keep having kids and grandkids, and the new generations. We want to create a better world for them.
Yes.
So all of us, with good intentions, need to keep pushing back.
I have a very dear friend who said, "Mary Jane, I know you are looking toward making things better, getting people to think about the better things." But she said, as long as there's human beings, there's always going to be conflict. There's always going to be war. And I said, I can't accept that. I think eventually we can get to it. Because I worry. I'm not worried about me because I figure, hey, I'm old. Eventually, I'm going to be gone. But I do worry about, you know, the kids and the grandkids and the ones that are growing up today that will never know what normal is. And I don't even know if we can even define normal anymore.
We can talk about normative. And normative takes that normal part and makes it an ethical obligation to be Unitarian, to look for the greatest utility for the most people in whatever happens. And that never happens
anymore. I like that. Can I use that? Normative?
Normative, yes.
Did you make that up?
It means doing the right thing.
Jeez.
And, you know, you're a communicator. So you're used to thinking through and talking and drilling down and solving problems. But you know that you can only solve problems if, the other party is ready to receive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Now, do you have a website?
It's being built right now.
Okay. When you build it, you come back and let me know so I can let people know about it. Now, what about the book, Passages? Is it out yet?
Oh, yeah. It's on the market. You can get it from your bookstore or library through Ingram Spark, and it's on Amazon. So, yes, it's available.
Fantastic.
And I would encourage people to take a look at some of the reviews, like the Kirkus review that it's gotten. I think people will enjoy it.
Fantastic. PK, thank you so
much. I want to ask you a question.
Yeah, sure.
Do we have any more time?
No, unfortunately, we've run out, but would you come back again?
I absolutely would. This has gone too fast. I'm enjoying your company so much.
Oh, right back at you. But yeah, we'll do this again, absolutely. And you take good care, and you can call me, or I'll call you, and we'll just figure out when we can do this again.
Thank you so much.
You betcha. Take good care, and have a great year.
Thank you. You too. You as well.
Once again, that's P.K. Edgewater, name of the book, Passages. Coming up, The Angel and the Avatar. Are we in a mental crisis? Or a soul crisis? Let's find out.
Calling all big thinkers. The world's climate is changing. These aren't new facts, but it means we must think in new ways about how we can live, prosper, and provide energy for our world while protecting our planet. Engineers are answering the call to create cleaner, safer, reliable energy. Solar power, harnessing the power of the sun to light all corners of the globe. Wind power, channeling a simple breeze to bring electricity to our homes. Hydropower, using the natural flow of water to generate electricity. Nuclear power, engineering advanced reactors that are safer, more reliable, and produce zero carbon emissions. Engineers are leading the way and empowering the next generation. Engineers Answer the Call, brought to you by the National Academy of Engineering. Learn more at nae.edu.
When I grow up, I want to be a ballerina.
Because dancing makes me happy. I get to entertain people, and nothing makes me feel more like me.
PI, a defect of the immune system, affects millions of children. Early and accurate diagnosis and treatment give children like Olivia a chance to achieve their dreams.
It takes a great team to put on a show. It also takes a great team of caring people to keep a dream alive. And now my dreams are coming true.
For more information, visit the Jeffrey Modell Foundation at info4pi.org.
Hey, you got any gum?
Yeah, check my backpack.
What's this?
Oh, that's naloxone. It can reverse an opioid overdose. I decided to always keep it on me after my friend almost died. It saved his life.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry. That makes me want to have it with me, too.
You totally should. Check the pharmacy. It was actually really easy to get, and it's easy to use.
I definitely will. Thanks.
Naloxone saves lives. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
Lacey J. Dalton always tells it like it is. Life is about now. You know, we've been talking about the mental health crisis that we're in this country and all over the world, actually. But Doreen Mary Bray, a naturopath and teacher of over 40 years, says it's really a soul crisis. And she wants to help us find that balance and better understand mind, body, and emotional well-being. She gives us tools in her book called The Angel and the Avatar. I love the name of the book. It bridges ancient wisdom and modern life, and add to her resume, she is a shaman. Nice to have you with us, Doreen.
Oh, thank you, Mary Jane. It's my pleasure.
Okay, what do you mean by soul crisis?
People today are so disconnected. They're functioning on nerves to perform better, to appeal to their peers, to their teachers and parents and other friends and schoolwork. And so they become very disconnected from their soul, from the parts of them that express deep inner peace.
I don't know what peace is anymore. Can you? Is it different for each person, or is there a definition that everybody is striving for called peace?
That's a really good question. To me, peace is when there's no thought, when my central nervous system is at a still point, which means breathing deep, being present to where I am, feeling compassion towards my environment, towards my body, towards my, you know, whoever is in my space. So that to me is peace, where there's no what if or uncertainties or questions in the moment, just stillness.
Yeah. You know, I think you're right. Because look at it. I mean, the technology that we have now with AI and, you know, the computers. And I mean, a computer used to take a block of a building, you know, building the whole block to fill. Now it's on our wrist, you know, or in a chip. It's just amazing. And yet we're still not happy. We're still not happy. We're not fulfilled. And it amazes me because you see, there's a high school about three blocks away from where we live. And I see the kids going to school in the morning. They don't look happy. They kind of just like heads down. They don't care very much about it. They're texting each other instead of talking to each other, which drives me crazy. But I just don't know where we're headed. It almost seems like we're headed to disaster if we don't figure it out.
Yes, I agree. When they walk with their heads down, there's multiple reasons. One is usually their books on their back are so heavy.
Oh, that's
true. They have to lean forward.
Yeah.
You know, also, like, if I said to you, there's a person in the next room sitting on the bed, and they are withdrawn, stressed, depressed, tell me in your mind's eye what they look like.
Say that again.
So if there was a person in the room beside me,
okay,
and I told you that they were stressed, they were depressed, they were not happy, they were sitting on the bed, how would their sitting position show itself?
I'd say shoulders kind of hunched over instead of being up and out. No smile on the face. No way. The eyes. I think I could see it in the eyes. The eyes don't have that sparkle that says, you know, I'm learning, I'm growing, I'm going to be happy. And that sparkle is gone. It's just gone. I'll give you an example. This was years ago when I was a reporter and not doing a talk show. And I interviewed at Folsom Prison two men, that were in prison for being multiple killers, multiple murderers. And I sat right across from them. And two things hit me. One is they talked about the murders as if you and I talk about our dinner that we had last night. The other is that there was nothing in the eyes. It was vacant. It was like I was looking into darkness, blackness, nothing alive. And that's the reason I always look into people's eyes. That tells me a lot. How about you?
Well, that really shows a total soul disconnect, because when we're connected to our soul, that our soul is light. And so that light then is reflected in the eyes. That's why you look at somebody and their eyes are sparkling. That's a pure connection.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that the people you were interviewing were definitely dead unto themselves.
Yeah.
They had no feeling, no remorse. Because the soul is compassion. Again, it's light, which is lightness towards life, towards everything in life. It's a wholeness.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
That disconnect is the issue. So when I asked you about the person sitting in the next room, you're right. They will be slumped over. Definitely their eyes will be dark. But more where I'm getting to is their head will be down. They'll be slumped over. They have this posture of defeat.
Yes.
Now, when they're sitting like that, if you think about it, now their stomach is being crushed up into their lungs.
Huh.
Their intestines are pushing the stomach up. This posture then puts the organs under stress. We are our organs. We sit upon them. They govern us. So now here you have a person, like you said, the teenagers walking down the street. They're hunched over. That posture itself will lead to depression, anxiety, and stress.
Wow. Okay. So over the years, you've been doing this for quite a while, right?
40 plus years.
There you go. Okay, so what patterns over the decades point to soul disconnection?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, when I was a kid, I would go into the health food, into the bookstore. There wasn't a health food store then.
Yeah.
Into the bookstore.
Yeah.
And you would see books on psychology, philosophy, witchcraft, maybe EFT. That was it. Now you go into a bookstore and it's wall-to-wall self-help, spirituality, you know, moving more towards light and this idea of consciousness. So we are being made present to the possibility that we are so much more. Whereas in the past, even this vocabulary we're using today, well, could have ended up in a mental institution.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So we do see we're growing. We're progressing as a society, as a species. We're becoming more open to the possibilities that this body has been incarnated here for a higher purpose, a calling. And so I see more and more people are moving in that direction. You see it with retreats, workshops, right? The like I said, the books, it's everywhere. So I think we're living in a brilliant age.
Yeah, but what are we searching for? Why do we keep looking, keep searching, keep trying new things? Why? Is it the human spirit? What is it?
If you think about, you know, I remember when I was young, you'd always hear that saying, I need to leave. I have to find myself.
Oh, I know. I found myself early on, so I didn't look. I wasn't looking.
Right, but the saying has been around forever.
Yeah, that's
where
true.
Where kids leave home because they have to find themselves, so they travel to Europe.
No. I disagree with you, Doreen. They're all going home. You know, they're living in their parents' basement now. You know, 34, 35
now.
Years old, and I'm going, what the heck? Would you have ever dreamed of going? I shouldn't say that. When my husband went to Vietnam, I stayed with my parents for a while I was in Indiana University to save some money, you know. But I never would have dreamed of moving back into my parents' house. I mean, come on. We at 18, 19 years old, it's like, I'm going to the university. I'm going to get my degree. I'm going to get out there and get work, no matter what it was. I mean, it didn't have to be a big money or anything. You just did it, and you went out on your own. And now I'm hearing that they're going home and they're living with their parents, and I'm going, this is not good. That shouldn't be that way, should it?
Well, not just that. Most of them don't even leave, never mind return.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. That's right.
I had a student, and she was, I guess, in her 50s. And one day we were talking, and she looked at her watch fast and said, "Oh, my God, I got to get home. I have to cook the dinner for my kids. I haven't done the laundry. Oh, geez, I got to go." And I looked at her, and I thought, she must have had kids really late in life.
Yeah.
I said, "How old are your kids?" And she said, "Well, my son is 42, and my daughter is 48.
No
and they've
way.
They've never left home."
Oh, my word. I hope you sat her down and gave her some advice.
No. You know, if somebody doesn't ask me for advice, I don't give it. I learned that. Not to pass.
Well, you're a nicer person because I would have started mouthing off an awful lot. Like, they should be taking care of you, not you them. You know?
I agree, but you know, hopefully, as she ages, the roles will switch.
Well, at 50, she should have changed those rules a long time ago. I'm amazed. 48 and 42, did you say? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Okay. So what kind of practices can realign that? Because I understand. I see what you're saying. Mind, body, and soul, they all work together. So do you have some ideas on how we can get them all to work together? Because it seems like they're all scattered out there.
I spend a lifetime of helping people to gather themselves together. But yes, definitely, if you know, some short ideas. First off, the body produces a voltage. As you know, the cells are electromagnetic. What that means is that the cells take in fluid through the thin membrane walls. Maybe if it's in the liver, it's going to be fats and oils. But regardless, the cells take in fluid through the thin membrane walls. It sets up a charge. Every cell then generates a charge. All the cells in an organ then generates that organ signature. And all together, that's our voltage. Now, if the cells, they don't have enough electrolytes, which are minerals,
yeah,
and that's how they hold the voltage, then they're not going to be able to generate a high electrical current. Now, the soul is high voltage.
Oh.
So I'll give you an example. If I took my TV and I plugged it into the wall, it worked. If I plug it into high voltage wires, what happens?
It'll blow up.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So now we can't just shove the soul or try to shove the soul into the body and align it when the voltage of the body is really low.
Okay.
So we need to first, in my mind anyway, help heal the body. So, you know, getting the minerals and you know, eating properly, not all of our...
Yeah, the physical part is what you're saying, right?
Yes. Okay. Because that connection, again, like the TV, it has to be on the same resonance.
Huh. Okay. You also refer to spiritual alignment. So if I get my physical in order, is the next step to go to the spiritual alignment? And how do I do that?
So some people go to retreats and workshops. They don't work on their body. They just want to, you know, the belief system is if I bring in soul, then I will heal. And I have seen that happen. Usually there's a lot of work that's done before that. That means parasite cleanses, organ cleanses, detoxes, in other words. But I have seen it happen in workshops like sweat lodge ceremonies or workshops where a person gets so deeply moved by their state of being, that uneasiness, that they stretch themselves out of who they are into what they envision that light, that soul to be. And I've seen that shift occur. Actually, it happened a 16-year-old boy that I had who was into goth and wanted to run away from home and leave school. And his mother brought him to a weekend workshop. And I swear, within that 8 hours, he transformed himself, because this is ourselves that has to stretch to become more, that so much so that his mom wasn't even sure it was him, because the way he stood changed, the looks in his eyes, as you mentioned, the eyes, he completely morphed into his greater self. And when they went home, he burnt all of his clothes that had skeletons on them. Huh. He continued his school. He's a scientist today. He went to university, and so I know it can happen.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but for most people, it takes a lot longer than 8 hours.
It's because of their belief system. If I have traumas from my youth that I haven't brought into healing, which means forgiveness, forgiving them, forgiving myself, you know, that process, then when I try to align my soul, these images are going to come to me, because it's basically what your essence is saying is, these are the parts of yourself you haven't healed that you need to look at.
Hmm. Do we have any influence, I guess is the word I'm looking for, any influence from maybe, do you believe in past lives?
Yeah, I remember my past lives.
Do you really?
I was born remembering them. I've known them all my life. I thought it was strange when people would ask me the question, because I'd kind of go like, what do you mean? Of course.
No kidding. Give me a few. How many? You've had a lot of past lives?
Oh, close to 1,000. So,
oh,
well, and
wow.
I mean, that's not just human form, though. I remember, really distinctly remember being a bird, for example. You know, we go through different forms. That's what spirit is. It manifests itself through these different forms in order to experience this reality through all the different perspectives, which means male body, female body, tall, short, fat, skin, skinny, you know, being a tree, being a horse, being a dog, being a... These gives you all the different perspectives of reality. If you were always a male in every life, you'd only have a male's attitude.
Oh, that's true. Well, do you ever get to a point where you don't have to keep coming back?
There is a point, and, you know, it's called an ascended master, which basically means they have experienced through all the different perceptions of reality. They have come into higher acknowledgement, higher consciousness, and then they can choose whether to return or not.
Well, the other ones, you don't choose, you just get tossed into it?
As long as you create karma, you have to come back to resolve the karma.
Okay, define karma.
So karma is I do serious harm to someone else, maybe repeatedly, to other people and so on and so forth. Well, that would be karma that I am accumulating, because if I don't pay off my debts in this life, in other words, I don't turn around and apologize and try to make right what I did wrong, if I don't practice forgiveness of them and myself, then that becomes a trigger or a charge, you could say, inside your body. And then that charge, you leave here, but that charge becomes a life of its own, where it has to be downloaded, released.
Oh, man. I got a whole bunch more questions to ask you, and we're running short on time, but I got to ask you one thing. I love the name of the book. I haven't seen it. The Angel and the Avatar. What? Explain that to me. I didn't know an angel and an avatar could be the same thing.
Well, when we are a soul, we are an angel. So because I do remember my past lives, I also remember my lives in between not having a physical body. So this is what birthed this book. So this book is about a soul, an angel, that really, really wants to come to Earth and embody herself into a form. And in order to do that, she has to go through all these trials and tribulations in heaven. So I found a way to express our journey. And so when you go on this journey with her, you remember your own journey. And I found a way to express it that brings recall to a person and helps them understand why they are living with the family they are in the form that they're in, male, female, tall, short, whatever. On the other side, when we are pure soul, our desire is an avatar. Our greatest desire is to come here and to fulfill a calling, a mission, a purpose. So the avatar is our human body. So it's about this angel on this journey.
Hmm. Yeah. The one thing I could never understand about reincarnation, why would a person choose, or maybe they don't choose, that's why I'm asking, to come back as a baby born and die in 6 months? I mean, why?
Because sometimes the soul only wants to experience, I mean, and it's the same with fetuses that you know, don't become a baby.
Yeah.
The soul wants to feel the cells multiply and grow. It wants to feel that connection to form, to reality. And maybe it even wants to be birthed into this world and experience the love of the parents, the environment. But they had no intentions of staying.
I'll be done. Hmm. And so then they go back into an angel form or just a spirit or what?
Yes. They once again become freed of their form, and they are still themselves. An example would be you're knocked unconscious, but then the next thing you know, you're standing next to your body, and you can see your body. But you are you, even though you're looking at your body, and you're going, what the heck? That's me down there, but this is me up, you know, standing next to it. So we do know for a fact that we are not that body.
Huh. So do we, I've been told, now I don't know if it's true or not, but I obviously listen to as many people as I can. I've been doing this for over 5 decades, so I've met a lot of people who have told me that I'm a very old soul, very old soul. How do they know?
It's a vibration that a person emits, how they speak, how they walk, how they talk. How they resonate in space and time. This points to the fact that they have seen reality through many different forms and many different eyes.
Hmm, okay. And so, but I'll never, I don't know for sure whether I'll keep coming back, though, because being old doesn't mean you're done, right?
You need to come back as long as you have karma that has not been addressed and healed.
Yeah, but what karma could I have with a bird or a tree?
I don't know. I have no idea. But perhaps when you're in those forms, it's not about karma so much as it is about your intention. Because each soul incarnates with desires and intentions, and if they're not being fulfilled, then that is another glitch in the system.
Ah, okay. Now, do you have a website, by the way?
Definitely. It's Doreen Mary Bray.
Okay, .com?
.com, yeah.
Okay. And the book, The Angel and the Avatar, available, yes?
Yeah, available on Amazon, in all your different bookstores, like Barnes & Noble, Kobo, if you just want it electronically.
Okay.
So, yes, it's there.
Okay. In 40 seconds or less, tell me what you want us to take away from The Angel and the Avatar.
That you are whole and complete unto yourself, that there is no problems with who you are, as long as you can release yourself from any feelings of guilt or debt, you are free.
Huh. I love it. I love it. You got to come back and visit again. We just got the tip of the iceberg. Okay.
Anytime, my love. Anytime.
Okay, Doreen, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, and stay well.
I will. Thank you, Mary Jane. I appreciate it.
You bet. In the meantime, folks, as I always say, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and above all else, dare to dream. Remember, if you can't dream, how do you make a dream come true? Take good care. Talk to you next time right here on Pop Talk.